Anyway, right. Moving swiftly.
Shall we?
As swiftly as humanly possible.
Indeed.
Onwards. The tape is rolling, so let's do this.
Let's. Hello, I'm Simon Mercier. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to entertainment in all its forms, but it has to be said, it's music and movies which tend to dominate the conversation between me and Steve McCabe.
And this week, we're making way for a blockbuster among blockbusters, truly. Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom roars into the cineplexes and the movie screens around the world. And we have to ask, is it that we truly can't wait for another chapter, or is it time for it to become extinct?
A deft touch with the script there, Mr. McCabe.
Yes. Yes.
Now, moving on, men will be boys, they say. That idea, that notion is very much at the heart of a new American buddy movie, although in this case the buddies include women as well as men.
They do.
The film is called Tag.
Now, we've got another Lost at Sea drama to have a chat about. It's called Adrift, and it's based on a true story. So is this going to be a satisfying voyage or a bit of a damp squib?
We shall see. That too, a true story. As in fact, I forgot to mention, Steve. Tag is based on a true story too.
True story.
Yeah, true story. And finally, having seen her as an opening act for Robbie Williams a few months ago, I have been listening the last few days to the new album from our very own Canadian Kiwi, Tammy Nielsen. The album is called Sassafras.
Absolutely. And if you want to take a more leisurely stroll through the ideas that Simon and I throw around during this podcast, visit us online. Don't forget, our website is cravepodcast.com. That's cravepodcast.com. And you'll find written reviews, you'll find concert photos, loads of notices of events coming up. So, let's get started, shall we? Simon.
Yes, we shall.
To the dinosaurs.
Hard to ignore the dinosaurs, it has to be said.
Indeed.
Steve, I was, for example, there have been a number of trailers, as there often are for lots of movies. This one is called Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. The first trailer, I just had a quick look before we did the podcast, Steve. It's had more than 55 million hits on YouTube.
And that's just a trailer, right?
That's just a trailer. So, wow. You know, clearly, many, many people all over the place are looking forward to this follow-up to 2015's Jurassic World. But I've got to say, I've got this funny feeling, I'm sure I'm right, that when we had talked about this coming up and at the end of our last podcast, I seem to recall you not jumping for joy at the prospect of seeing this.
I could have lived without it.
Ah.
Now, I did find myself thinking early in the film, is it that Steven Spielberg and his production company need the money for another Jurassic film, or does the world actually need another Jurassic film? And I have to go with, I think it's the former. This felt like, and I think you've mentioned this in our online review, it's an exercise in box ticking, isn't it?
There's a lot of box ticking. There is indeed, and we go through that. Perhaps I'll just do a very, very quick sort of sketch out of where this film is starting and heading. It does pick up from the end of the previous film, which where you might remember that huge marine dinosaur, the Mosasaurus, slid up out of the big lake and gobbled up the Indominus Rex, and our the Velociraptor called Blue and the T-Rex, which had been fighting the Indominus Rex, triumphantly marched back off into the interior of the island. And we had our two heroes, Owen, played by Chris Pratt, and Claire, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, proceeded to conclude the rekindling of their former romance. So that was where the last film ended up. And this one starts off back at the island in that lake. There's a sequence which reintroduces a certain aquatic dinosaur. And then we are onto this journey where you've probably seen this on the trailer. That island is about to be disintegrated by a massive exploding volcano. And so the question is what to do with the dinosaurs. It turns out that Claire and Owen and a few other sidekicks return to rescue them. And the whole question of why should you rescue them, what should you do with them, if you do rescue them, where should they go and what uses they should be put to, is really at the heart of the plot of this middle chapter, Steve, right? Because we've had one, this is the second, it's clearly going to be a third.
They will never end.
No, but well, there's at least going to be another one, and this is setting up the third chapter. So we can tell you, and you've seen this in the trailer, that you see the sequences of the dinosaurs fleeing from the volcano, jumping into the water, and the question is, where do they go? So we don't want to spoil it too much, but that pretty much sets the plot in motion right through the story.
Yeah, and I don't think we're going to spoil it, to be honest. I think that, quite frankly, the makers of the film spoiled it.
Please elaborate.
Well, I mean, yeah, you sketched out the plot, and the plot doesn't actually. I mean, there's two different plots almost in this. You've got first of all the should we save the dinosaurs from Isla Nuba? Or Nubar, yes. Nubler, whatever you call it, I can't remember what it's called. Yeah, the island of Costa Rica. Should they save it? So that's the first plot line, and obviously I don't think it's a spoiler to say that they obviously decide that they will, and that goes on for the first hour.
Yeah,
and then once that's all played out, then we get the second hour, which is suddenly Toby Jones appears out of nowhere as evil auctioneer, which is a tricky act to pull off if you think about it. it's like having a diabolical accountant. It's not an image that springs readily to mind, but he's an evil auctioneer who's flogging these things off to Russians mostly, because, you know, evil Russians is an image that springs readily to mind, obviously. And it's almost like it's a different film. The only thing that unites them is endless human versus dinosaur battles.
Yes. Absolutely. And I, for one, especially the humans hiding from the dinosaur and hiding around, you know, furniture and whatnot as the dinosaurs creeping around, that type of scene, which we've seen so much, only in this latest film, but even going back to the original Jurassic Park movies, that if you've seen it a few times, that's beginning to wear a little bit thin, I've got to say.
I think you're being generous there, mate. I just wanted it to be over.
Yeah. That second hour you're talking about, Steve, also involved in that is this whole idea of the genetic tinkering that's gone on to make these dinosaurs, right? Mm-hmm. And could there be even more? I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say, well, you'd expect there to be absolutely that, and that is indeed where the story heads. And, you know, just thinking about you used that good phrase, ticking boxes. I did a little sort of a little checklist.
Yes, you did,
because
didn't you?
I just sort of thought this is where we're up. You can, and again, this is most of this is from the trailer. So, are we going to see an even more dangerously genetically engineered dinosaur?
Yes, we are.
Of course. Have we seen the last of the Velociraptor?
No, we haven't.
Have we seen the last of the T-Rex?
Absolutely not.
Could there be some young sidekicks, you know, sort of coming along for the ride?
Most definitely.
Oh, yes. And particularly some youngsters, some kids who we've seen in just about every other Jurassic movie.
Absolutely, it's in there too.
So, I mean, it's and of course, there's some bad guys around there who are going to, surely they'd want to make some money weaponizing whatever else they're going to do with these dinosaurs. And we can tick that box, surely.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. So it's almost as though we've seen this film before, isn't it?
It is. It is that same sort of set of elements which are in the mix of the plot. Now, the story is moving in the sense that we've got some geographical changes to where things are happening.
Yes.
But the essence of it is the same. It is the same. And you'd be thinking that whenever we get to the third movie, we're probably going to have that same mix again. I would have thought.
More than likely, to be perfectly honest. Because they've obviously figured out that that's how you make a Jurassic film. Stick those elements in a different order. What they did forget, the boxes they didn't tick, were a little bit of comic relief.
Yes.
Which was is so po-faced and so desperately dry, this film. We got Chris Pratt, who gets glimpses. I think there's maybe two or three occasions.
Yeah, just a couple of little. Yeah.
That remind you that he's actually quite funny and isn't given the chance to be. He does a nice bit of physical comedy at one stage.
Yes.
He's got a couple of decent lines, but otherwise he scowls and he gurns his way through it joylessly. Yeah. And the whole thing just feels like a terribly joyless experience. Bryce Dallas Howard, if I were her, I'd want my money back. She doesn't get to do anything in this film except look a little bit pained. She's better than that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in the first of these latest iterations of Jurassic Park-World, there was quite a good little zest and frisson between her Bryce Dallas Howard and Chris Pratt in that first film. But in this one, it feels a little bit a well-tread tire. It doesn't really have anywhere to go because it's a holding film in the middle, isn't it? And
exactly,
so they're trying to sort of give it a bit more spark, but not too much, because they've got to leave something left for the third film. I kind of felt a bit sorry for the actors at times, thinking they're not giving you much to go with here, really.
It feels like what little plot there is just a way of connecting from one big dinosaur chase to the next.
Yes, and they, I think that's fair. And so it didn't really sing to me, this movie. It's not like absolutely awful. I mean, there are lots of other big budget blockbusters which are probably worse, but I think the first one, I quite enjoyed the first one, and I didn't enjoy this one as much, and I was disappointed by that.
But we're going back 20 years to that first one, aren't we? 20 some years.
Oh, the very first one, yes. I'm sorry. I mean, we had the first three, didn't we, which are, as you say, 20 years ago, and now this lot is the second of the latest batch, if you like.
Yes.
There's one character, Steve, who I saw his face and I thought, oh, where have I seen that guy before? He's the guy who's on the island leading the soldiers trying to round up the dinosaurs.
Yes.
The glasses, and he's trying to take souvenirs of dinosaurs' teeth.
Yes.
It took me a long time to figure out where I'd seen him before.
Go on.
His name's Ted Levine.
Yes.
And he was the serial killer in Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, wow. Now, that's 30 years ago.
Yeah, I have actually had to look it up afterwards, because I thought, I just couldn't, looking a little bit older, of course, but that's just a by the by.
Yeah, but so, since you mentioned the earlier films, I think it's worth going back to the very first ones, because there's a moment in this new one, the first time that, I'm going to have to go and have a quick look on the internet here, because I can't remember the name of the actor in question, but there's a...
We would remember him.
No, there is a paleo veterinarian.
Oh, yeah,
describes himself
as
at one point in this film.
Zia.
Is
the character's name. The actress is Daniela Pineda.
That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she gets to be the dinosaur enthusiast seeing dinosaurs for the first time. She gets to do that scene.
Yes,
this time, and it's a brontosaurus whose head sort of periscopes in, and you get the big sweeping stirring music being played, and all you can think is, when that was Sam Neill and Laura Dern doing that,
yes,
you know, remember that big pasture?
Yeah, I do.
You remember? I mean, that scene's brilliant.
It is
that scene. Then that's the first time we saw dinosaurs.
That's right.
And that got you. That's gone. They've lost any of that magic for me now.
Well, it's just that we've seen so much of it. We're a bit jaded. I have to say one thing.
Go on.
That I went we're recording this on a Sunday, and I took my grandson Blake along to see it, because he was busting a boiler to see it, Steve. And there are a lot of other youngsters there in the cinema. When I say young, like, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8, that sort of age. Yeah,
that counts as young without making you sound old, yes.
Yeah. And they were so into it. So I guess for a young person, the wonder of seeing a dinosaur on screen is still there. And there's one particular scene near the end of the island sequence, a poignant, sad little scene. And one fellow on the same row from me, I could hear him sobbing his heart out. And his mum had to pick him up and cuddle him and, you know, reassure him. And so
there are a few intense moments, aren't there? Yes,
there are a few intense moments. And so there are some people out there who will enjoy it. There's no doubt. They might be very young. So but I guess they're trying to bank up some fans for future movies. Just one other final thought, Steve. What did you make? There was one little twist they threw in there along the genetic engineering line, because, of course, all these dinosaurs have been cloned from old cells from amber and whatnot.
Yeah.
They took that slightly different direction with the cast, and we won't spoil that.
No, but I know where you're going with that.
Yeah, I mean, how did that sit with you? I wasn't sure about that myself.
If you talk about the same thing that I think you're talking about, it's something that's mentioned once, very briefly, in passing, and then dropped. And all you can think is, they're teeing something up there
for
the inevitable next episode. I don't like that as a filmmaking trait.
Yep. I think that's fair. It was, as we said, it's kind of got that feeling of you're just setting the stage for the next chapter, the third, and how many more there'll be, goodness knows.
Oh, God.
Anyway.
I mean, we've always asked the question in the past, would you recommend this?
I would have to say it's not as good as the preceding one.
No.
By several notches in my book. I wouldn't say you mustn't see it, because there is a continuing story here, and I suppose the end of the first one, it left so much up in the air. You're probably, there's a big curiosity factor to say,
yeah,
where are they taking the story? So, look, it's got its usual, you know, thrills and spills. It's a bit long, dragged a bit here and there, didn't really tick the right boxes for us, but I won't going to outright condemn it, but it's not a good entry in the canon.
No, it's not. And I just have to mention, before we wrap this up, the blatant racism early in it.
You
might not have picked up on this.
Hold on, let me just I'm just scraping. Okay, I think I maybe just can you say a little bit more about it?
Well, there's a moment early on when there's a young lady, a young girl named Maisie, who's being schooled by her maid, and they both speak with English accents, and young Maisie says that she has to have a bath, and her matron corrects her and says, bath, not bath,
yes.
You're not a wild animal.
That's right.
And
you took offence.
Well, of course, I thought proper. I come from up north where we say bath.
That's interesting, because I think I took it to be a go at the American accent, who'd also say bath.
I wasn't quite sure, but like I say, given that they both spoke English otherwise.
Yeah, I guess so. You're probably right.
So it didn't sit at all well with me, that one.
Deary. Oh. And, actually, by the... Mm.
And the lass who said it, Geraldine Chaplin.
Yes, Geraldine Chaplin, exactly.
Is indeed the daughter of...
Charlie.
The man himself.
Yeah, isn't that incredible?
Yeah, who'd have thought that Charlie Chaplin's kids are still on screen?
I know, it's amazing.
I mean, I know his granddaughter, Una, is in Game of Thrones.
She died in the Red Wedding, did she?
She was the mother.
Oh, okay, goodness
me. Or the pregnant, the soon to the expectant
mother.
Yes.
Wow.
I know. Who would have wrote? But anyway, blatant, disgraceful racism, and I was appalled.
Oh, dear.
Not that anyone cares in the slightest.
Possibly not, but anyway, never mind. It depends where you come from. Anyway.
Careful, Mercep, don't start.
All right, I won't.
It's called English for a reason.
It is, yes. I've got not a drop of it, so I'm no position to...
Right, let's move on. Yes. Let's move on. So from the imaginary island of Isla Nublar, or whatever we're calling it, to a slightly realer island. Let's go to Tahiti, where we've got the two central characters. Now, we're calling it a romantic drama, right? It's certainly a drama. I'm not sure how romantic it is. We're talking about Adrift. Starts this week. And I know you were at the preview. I couldn't make it, but you got to the preview this week, Simon. What did you make of it?
Well, first of all, I think it is a romantic drama, definitely. This is a very, as I said in my review online, cravepodcast.com, quite a tricky one to review. It is based on a true story. And if you knew, it's from 1983, if you either knew that story or you heard about the film and then you went and did a bit of reading about it to find out the true story on which it's based, then you really are going to have a completely different emotional experience as opposed to someone who goes in to see the film not knowing anything about the backstory, the true story. I did not know anything about that true story. And so the way this story is laid out, there's a major revelation left right at the end, which packs quite an emotional punch. So I had the benefit of that, not because I went into it in ignorance.
Right.
And probably that's the way to do it. And I think I don't know what it would be like if you knew beforehand what was coming. I suspect it's just not going to be as emotionally interesting and satisfying as it would otherwise be. But basically, we've got basically just really a two-person film, Steve. We've got, as I say, set in 1983. We've got a young woman called Tammy. She's a young Californian woman in her early 20s. She's basically off seeing the world, sailing around the world, picking up odd jobs here and there, doing her OE. She turns up in Tahiti, picks up a job at the wharf, loading up stuff alongside a young New Zealand girl called Deb. And they're working away when a British yachtie sails in. His name's Richard. He's a bit older, in his early 30s, I think, played by Sam Claflin. Tammy, by the way, is played by Shailene Woodley. That's the actress who plays her. And basically, they get together and they have a blossoming romance. I was going to say romance. I was thinking of the previous conversation about bath and bath. A romance.
You're really pushing it tonight, aren't you?
And eventually they agree that they will sail together. And there's an op around the world, and there's a particular yacht. The owners want them to sail it from Tahiti across the Pacific to San Diego. It's 4,000 nautical miles.
What could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong? What goes wrong is that a hurricane by the name of Raymond goes wrong. They sail into it. The yacht is severely damaged and is left adrift at sea for weeks, hence the title and hence the drama.
But Raymond, it's one of the least one of the least menacing names imaginable. You can't call
Hurricane Raymond.
Yeah. No. But seriously,
I think that maybe the names got more menacing as they've started to run out of traditional friendly names. I don't know. The story is – so that's the guts of it. And the story is told in two timelines. And I think the director is a guy called Baltazar Kormakur. I think he does quite a good job with this. You actually start the story in the immediate aftermath of the storm with the yacht damaged.
Oh, okay.
But then you backtrack – to the original meeting of the two characters, Tammy and Richard. And this movie continues to intercut between the two timelines, so you continue to build up the backstory of how they got on,
right,
how the romance grew, how they got to get where they are, plus dealing with the drama of being adrift at sea. So that I thought that, for me, that worked quite well, because I think if you'd just done it in a linear fashion, it could have got a bit boring. The other thing that impressed me, I haven't done a lot of sailing, but I've done a little bit of sailing, and I thought they did a very good job of the filmmakers of taking us on board the boat. I thought the sounds worked very, very well.
Yeah.
You really felt like you were on board. The photography was good. Sometimes it was handheld and close. Other times it was a bit more panoramic. And in particular, Shailene Woodley playing Tammy, and really it's her movie, I thought she gave a very, very good performance. I think she's been around for a while. I don't know if I've seen her before, but I think she's in those Divergent movies, for example.
Yes, which I know. I wasn't rushing out to see.
No, nor me. But I enjoyed her performance here very much. She had a kind of a, for want of a better way of putting it, it just felt genuine. It didn't feel like it was an actor.
Right.
It could have been a documentary. It had sort of... just a very not histrionic, and it was just felt like a real person we were watching. I found her a very engaging actor, and we see her having to put her sailing skills and her common sense to use to try and repair the yacht, because we see that Richard has been injured in the accident and is really too injured to help her.
Okay.
So, and I found myself really willing Tammy on to success in all this. So I thought that was very good. There was a fault for me, and it was as the film grew on, it really nagged at me. We've seen this guy, this actor, Sam Claflin, before. I think you and I both saw him and Emilia Clarke in that movie. He's a quadriplegic.
Me Before You.
He's a good-looking, sweet guy.
Yeah.
And to me, the character was just too good to be true. He was too kind and thoughtful and considerate and it just felt a little bit too saccharine,
right,
given that the rest of it felt quite gritty.
Oh, okay.
Now, as it turns out, and this is the hard part of reviewing this film, Steve, I think there's a particular reason for that. But I'm not going to say what it is because I really don't want to spoil the film for you. But if you do see it, and maybe I actually think, and maybe in another two or three podcasts, I might come back and just touch on this again, because I'd be interested if anyone else has a view on it. But I think there's a reason why we've got an actor playing it like that. That's all I'll say. But the ending, if you've got your plot detection antenna out, I don't know how, you may or may not be that surprised. But I thought it was a good ending. It reinforced The acting skills of Shailene Woodley playing Tammy Oldham. And so all in all, I thought it was actually quite good. Not as good as it could have been, but then there is a reason for it being the way it is. And that's,
and you,
yeah.
You've piqued my curiosity now. I'm going to have to go and see it.
Well, yeah, go on. I mean, I think it hasn't had great reviews overseas. I've sort of seen that. And I was trying to figure out why I quite liked it. It is a film in our backyard. It's Tahiti. There are a few New Zealand actors in it playing very small little roles. But
of course,
it does have it has got that Pacific sort of feel that feels a little bit local. And that may have been one of the reasons why, even though it's an American and a British are the two main characters, it just felt like it was in our backyard a little bit. And
right.
That may have been a bit of a reason why I warmed to it. And also the main actor, her role, I thought she did a very good job. So there you are. Pretty good. Not absolutely outstanding, but pretty good. And I would recommend you having a look at it.
And just to mention in passing, one of Shailene Woodley's earliest TV credits, she was in Everybody Loves Raymond.
You're kidding me.
Just seen it on IMDb right now. In 2004. It just seems kind of...
Isn't it bizarre?
Yeah, there's a certain symmetry to that one.
There is. Kismet.
Indeed.
Oh, wow. Gosh. Okay.
So anyway.
Right. Yes. Well, I think we should move on to something that is not about drama at sea or dinosaurs chomping their way through humans. Steve, there's an American comedy out called Tag.
Yes.
Like Adrift, it is based on a true story. So how did this play for you? Did it make you laugh? Did it give you a bit of a warm, fuzzy message about mateship?
Well, on paper, this should have been complete and utter poo, shouldn't it, really? you've got the story of five blokes, who are middle-aged, who, when they were children, started a game of tag, and to this day are carrying it on, and every year they take the month of May to continue their game of tag, and whoever's it at the end of May spends the year in shame.
That's right.
And they go to extraordinary lengths to tag each other during the course of May. And it sounds like the most bizarre, implausible, nonsense setup.
Yeah.
And yet somehow, I think largely it's down to the charms of the cast. We've got Ed Helms, we've got John Hamm, Jake Johnson, we've got Hannibal Buress, and we've got Jeremy Renner as the five, who are playing grown men playing tag.
Yeah. Yep.
And they make it work. They manage to bring so much charm and serious, well done humor to this. You've got the screenplay played by Rob McKittrick and Mark Stylan, which is genuinely funny.
It is. I agree.
It's a very simple idea. It could easily cross over into saccharine, schmaltzy sickliness, and yet it doesn't. They actually managed to keep it really funny. Part of it is because of what a bizarre character Jerry is, played by Jeremy Renner, the one guy who's never ever been tagged.
That's right.
And they're desperate to get him. And a lot of the film revolves around them trying to get him without ruining his wedding. And
that's right.
It's just bloody good fun.
It is good fun. It is good fun. And it's it is, you know, these grown men finding their inner boy and putting aside the rest of the trappings of their lives for a few weeks a year. And I was like you. My expectations were only middling at best, but I enjoyed the banter, you know, the way they just talk like they're like kids in the schoolyard, aren't they, sometimes when they – and they're like – it just takes you back. I thought it was quite well done. There's some lovely slow-mo sort of comedic action sequences as they try to get tag the Jeremy Renner character, Jerry.
Yes.
And they were hilarious. It sounds like it's just a male buddy movie, but there's some strong female characters in it. Hoagie's wife, Anna, the former girlfriend, Cheryl. There's a Wall Street Journal reporter. Then Jerry's fiance. They're all in there, and they're very much part of the story and of the bubbling away of what's going on here. So it's a lot of physical humor, but also a lot of some nice scripted lines as well.
Yes.
It's nothing to be taken hugely seriously. Although, Steve, I don't know. I have to say, I'm sure this is what they were hoped would be happening amongst the male audience watching this film. That as I was watching it, I was thinking, oh, you know, there's that so-and-so, I haven't called him up for a long, long time. I really must give him a bell and see how he's getting on, you know, that type of feeling.
Yes. It was surprisingly sweet. I mean, it's a film you go in with low expectations. You think it's going to be just a little bit of fluff and a bit of nonsense.
Yeah.
And you bring out of it an awful lot more than you take in, I think.
Yeah. I enjoyed it very much. And there's a couple of two or three, apart from the central cast we've mentioned, a couple of lovely little cameos
Yes.
that they worked in. I really enjoyed. There's a brief scene with an actor called Lil Rel Howery,
Yes.
who I recognized him as soon as I saw him, and he played the sidekick of Daniel Kaluuya in Get Out, which
Yes,
we both
yes.
loved last year. And he's there in a very nice little turn. He's hiring Hoagie, isn't he, for a job?
Ed Helms, yes.
Yes. And then we've got, I thought, a wonderful scene where Nora Dunn plays Hoagie's mum. And in one scene, she's kind of
Oh, she's fantastic.
sidling up to Randy. I thought that was a brilliantly played little scene too.
It's very, very well done. Yeah, I mean, you've got Annabelle Wallis as the Wall Street Journal
Yep.
reporter who basically teases exposition out of the various characters so that the whole concept can be explained to the audience.
Yes.
She's there for a very good reason. I was less impressed with Rashida Jones as the love interest. I felt like
The
they could have
former
left
girlfriend, yeah.
that out and you wouldn't have missed it.
Yeah, that's probably fair. Yeah, she, yeah.
But then at the same time, Isla Fisher as Hoagie's wife brings almost terrifying intensity
I
to it. She's
know, I know.
fantastic.
She
She's
was
more
very
into the
good.
game than the boys are.
That's
Brilliantly
right.
good fun.
Yeah.
And I have to say, there's one thing, and I mentioned this with Ocean's 8, and I also mentioned it with Ghostbusters recently.
Yeah.
If you're going to put a token black character in, at least write them a decent character.
Yes, I mentioned this to my reviewers online as well. I thought of you when I saw that, Steve. Yeah, it's the character. I mean, I don't know whether in the original group of friends on whom this movie is based, there was a black guy amongst them. I don't know, but we have an actor called Hannibal Buress playing Sable, and he's the one black guy in the group, and he's got a few more deadpan sort of lines he's given, but it just raises that question in the back of your mind, doesn't it? Whether it is some sort of a doffing of the cap towards some sort
Yeah.
of broader ethnic mix in the film. And I don't, you know.
Got to get your token black bloke in there somewhere, haven't you? Yeah. But setting those quibbles aside,
Yeah.
wasn't it awfully good fun?
It was good fun. I would really recommend it. And don't be put off if you think it is just a bloke's movie, because I don't actually think it is. I mean, it's a men and woman movie, I think, and I think it is. I mean, maybe we should get Debbie to see it and see what she says. But I really enjoyed it. So
Yeah, I'd definitely
a big tick.
recommend it too.
Yeah, I would recommend that one. It's
Absolutely.
a tick.
Now, listen, before we go,
Yes.
because time is getting a bit better, obviously.
Time is money.
We know how time limited podcasts are. So before we go, we talked last week about a local album by a local band. We talked about Alien Weaponry,
Yeah.
but let's go to like almost the opposite end of the musical spectrum. They were hardcore heavy metal, weren't they?
They certainly were. My God.
But I know that you've been listening this week to something a little bit less heavy and less metal.
By a great stretch, yes. I have been listening to a woman who was once a Canadian but now a New Zealander, Tammy Nielsen, and she has a new album out called Sassafras. I think it's been out for maybe a week or two now. Yeah, I've been having a good listen to that one.
Now, I know you saw her open for Robbie Williams at Spark Arena a few months ago,
Yeah.
and you spoke very highly of her then, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard her at all, but she's one of those singers, a little bit like Adele, in that she's got a big voice. I mean, she can really put some volume and power into her voice,
Right.
and has a bit of the air of a diva about her.
Okay.
That might be a fair way to put it. I've actually got the album cover in front of me, and I think, and she's called it Sassafras, which is, like, I guess, means sassy, you know, and she's dressed in this bright pink tight-fitting dress. It's adorned with embroidered bananas,
Okay.
snakes, a fork skewering a strawberry,
Okay.
and what looks like, I'm pretty sure, the hand of a devil clutching an apple with a bite taken out of it.
Okay, not an image that springs readily to mind, but we'll go with
No.
it.
And she's got jet black hair, bright red lipstick. It's an extremely striking image, and I guess it's basically all about temptation. That's what I'm taking it from to be.
Sounds fair. Now, I know you said she's Canadian, right?
Yes.
And I know you've said in the past that she sort of started out country, but I also seem to remember that when you saw us opening for Robbie Williams, you were saying that live she sort of started to branch out a little bit.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, she was really belting out some quite up-tempo sort of numbers, and that's reflected in this album. I should mention the songs are all written by her. Certainly all the lyrics are in the music, and there's a couple of other of her band members helping around on some of the music. But yeah, you've got something like a Caribbean Cuban style song called Bananas.
Okay.
A very slow 50s style crooning little number called One Thought of You. The opening up-tempo, very ballsy sort of a Shirley Bassey type style song called Stay Out of My Business. A sumptuous ballad called Manitoba Sunrise at Motel 6.
Oh, great title.
Funky name, but
oh, it's a great title. I love it.
Yeah. but her voice is such that she can definitely tackle all these genres.
So it doesn't sound just scattershot then, no?
Well, I have to say that is the one question about it, listening to it. It is a real grab bag of different styles.
Okay.
And I was kind of wondering, what am I being presented with here? You know, what am I clutching on to? Is there a theme? Well,
which pigeonhole can you drive her into?
Right. Well, musically, this album isn't really able to be pigeonholed so much, but thematically in the lyrics, it is quite consistent. Just as last week we were talking about alien weaponry, you know, really striking a blow for justice for Maori. Tammy Nielsen's lyrics are very consistent, and in the album dedication that she writes, she says, "For every woman and man fighting the good fight for equality."
Can't argue with that.
So she's basically talking about equal rights for women in all manner of aspects of life, and that comes through in all the songs.
Right.
And yeah, so there is a consistency there, if not in the actual music style.
Okay, fair enough. So I mean, I guess ultimately, right? Bottom line is, did you like it?
That's right. Mostly, yes.
Ooh.
Perhaps not quite as wholeheartedly as I wanted to. And I think that's possibly because there is such a mix of musical styles, Steve, that I don't think every song will appeal to everyone unless you've got such a broad taste, you know?
Yeah.
I found, in fact, quite a few of the songs I really liked, and that one with the wonderful name Manitoba Sunrise at Motel 6, I thought that was my favorite. And I'm not usually a country fan, but I thought that was beautiful, beautiful, sumptuous ballad. And what I liked about it was that she does use that big voice of hers to belt out some of those up-tempo songs, but
yeah,
she found some lovely tenderness in this ballad.
Cool.
That I thought was lovely. I did wonder whether the fact that it's the one song which is geographically rooted in her Canadian homeland might have had something to do with that feeling that I heard in her voice. But
interesting thoughts.
Not an absolute standout, but a very good and strong album, and I would recommend it.
Fair enough, then.
So there.
Right. Well. Now that you've convinced me to give that a listen, should we have a quick look at what's coming up in the near future?
Please let us do that.
Because there's a thing or two, you know.
Yeah. Well, away you go.
Okay. Are you a fan of Talking Heads?
Yes.
I mean, given that you have been one.
Thank you.
Historically,
thank you. And they are up there in one of my all-time favorite concerts. I saw them, Stephen, about 1983. Three or four.
Heavens.
Here in New Zealand.
Fabulous.
They came to, we used to have way back then, Steve, some festivals like Glastonbury in the UK that go out like for 2 or 3 days.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was for a few years, there were some called Sweetwaters.
I think I've heard of this, yes. It sounds familiar.
And they came and performed along with many other bands at Sweetwaters about in the early 80s, and I thought they were fantastic. And one of the things I remember from the, you know, 30 more the years ago was that I think Byrne came out by himself to begin with an acoustic guitar, played the first song on acoustic, and then for each song after, one more musician joined him.
What a brilliant idea.
So it took 4 or 5 songs before you had the full band on stage.
Oh,
I thought it was brilliant. I remember that, you know, decades later. But so that there's news about him, isn't there?
Yeah, you'll be able to relive some of that in November.
Mm.
They're going to be in TSB Arena in Wellington on the 13th.
Yeah.
Horncastle Arena in Christchurch on the 15th. And then Spark Arena in Auckland on the 17th of November. And then after that, they go off to Australia, and we don't really care about that anymore. But they're going to be, well, I say they, he. So it's very definitely a David Byrne thing. He's got a full backing band, quite an extensive backing band.
Right.
But it's being billed as the David Byrne's American Utopia Tour.
So that okay.
Could be worth a look.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. I would say definitely. I would say that would be quite high on my list.
We shall bear that in mind when the time comes.
Thank you so much.
Now, I'm guessing possibly slightly lower on your list. Are you familiar with Panic! At the Disco?
I've heard the name, definitely, and I think they've been around for a while, have they not?
They have indeed. But they're going to be here on, a month earlier, Tuesday the 16th of October.
Okay.
They will be with us at, where are they playing? Spark Arena.
Okay.
In Auckland.
Well, are they indeed a poppy disco-y band, or is that just
kind of. If I'm not mistaken, the title is actually derived from a Smiths song. So you can decide for yourself exactly how poppy and upbeat they're going to be if they're singing Smith songs.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough, yes.
Possibly a little bit, I don't know, I'm not quite sure what the word is, not totally our scene, but are you familiar with Elaine Page?
Oh, yes, from Phantom of the Opera. Isn't she well known for that?
Yeah, she's done a lot of Tim Rice and Roy Webber stuff.
Yeah, okay.
And she is going to be doing quite an extensive zip around New Zealand in October. There we go. Find the dates on our website. That's cravepodcast.com.
Okay.
Dates are there. But I think probably the most interesting announcement, the most impressive show we're going to see next year, Florence and the Machine.
Okay, that would be a good show.
I have a feeling that's going to be a really big one. That's going to be Wednesday the 30th of January.
Okay. Oh, we've got time to save up our pennies for that.
Absolutely. Tickets go on sale on June the 28th, so you better get saving fast.
I'll just mention a couple of things very quickly, if I may, Steve.
Please do.
This is way outside what we normally do, but there is something I hope you were invited to. There's a preview of the World Press Photo Exhibition this coming week in Auckland. I've said I'm going to go along, and we'll get a chance to talk to the curator. These are usually actually fairly stark and grim photographs from the news media from around the world, but compelling. So this coming Friday, I'm going to go along to Smith & Coe's in Queen Street and have a chance to have a little look at that.
Fantastic.
And there's one film that's being previewed this coming week, Steve, that I really enjoyed the first one of. There was a film called Sicario.
Yes, I remember you talking about this, yes.
Yeah, and it was that by that director, Denis Villeneuve.
Yes.
It had Emily Blunt. It had Benicio del Toro, Josh Brolin. And it was a gritty, violent, but compelling drug war movie.
And I remember you speaking very, very highly of it.
Yeah, I thought it was really very well done and really took you to the dusty border between Texas and Mexico. Now there's a follow-up. It's being previewed this coming week. It's called, I think, Soldado or Day of the Soldado.
That sounds about right, yeah.
Emily Blunt isn't in it, which is a shame because she was pretty much the heart and soul of the first film. It's not the same director. And I think my gut tells me it's not quite going to be as good, but I will go and see it and report back to you.
I really ought to catch up with the original film before.
I think you can, rent it or whatever. One of the things I recall about it particularly is some fantastic camera work that shows you the stark dryness of that Texas, northern Mexico area.
Yeah.
And also it was one of those films where the violence is shown as you imagine gun violence really would take place. It's not Hollywoodized. It's quite awful, but it's done in a very
honest
and sickening way, and so it's all the more effective because of that. So the only thing I like, the first I've seen the trailer, a bit of the trailer of this film. They've got a tagline, "This time there are no rules," which I think is a bit of a misnomer, because in the first film, I thought there were no rules. So I think they're... I'm not sure where they're going with this one. But anyway, I think we'll see where it goes, and I'll report back to you.
It sounds really good. I mean, like I say, you raved about the first one. I remember a couple of years ago, you were very impressed.
Kind of like Emily Blunt, and it had a good look about it. Anyway,
yes.
So... that's us. Thank you for listening to us, to Steve and I. And if you would like to get in touch with us, you're very welcome. You can email us on podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook. And all the cool kids these days are finding us on Twitter. We're at Crave Podcast.
Lovely. So I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Good man.
Jolly good.
Well, that went about as well as could be expected, didn't it?